Sure.
Good afternoon, everybody. Hopefully, I'm not going to stand in the feedback zone here. First and foremost, I just need you to let you know you don't have to adjust your glasses or anything. I'm not Dr. Jerry Cullum. He is under the weather today. I am standing in for him. My name is John Jakewith. I'm the test development manager at MDE. And my start with MDE was actually in the role of assessment consultant for students with disabilities. So I'm very familiar with my access. And then also with us today is?
I'm Dan Evans, and this is also a mic check, I guess. Can you hear me okay in the back? And I work on the administration and reporting for my access. So at times we work fairly close together, making sure it all comes together. And by the way, if those doors, if you would maybe close one of them or both of them, sometimes traffic just really interferes with the folks in the back. So, yeah, thank you.
So, before we get started, I thought we'd get an idea of who all is in the room. How many folks here are classroom level teachers, special ed administrators, building or district level administrators, state or business partners? Okay, great. Anybody I missed? All right. State partner.
She raised her hand.
But we'd like to introduce
you.
She's our assistant. This is Kate Cermak. She is our assistant director for everything assessment for the state. So good to have you with us.
So we're going to go through, you're going to do the introduction, right? Oh, okay. So we're going to go through a couple things. I'm going to walk you through a little bit about my access and the legislation that has led up to the participation rules around my access, the 1% cap. Anyone not familiar with the 1% cap? I'll probably do a brief off the slide summary of some of the content with my access. The content isn't changing much, but I'll just go over a couple things. And then Dan's going to get into a lot of the practical pieces with you on the administration of the assessment. Anybody giving my access for the first time this year? Okay, good. Then that'll be really good information for you. And if you've given my access once, twice, or 25 times, it's still good to hear because we do have some things that are changing. So that'll be good. So my access has been around longer than the Every Student Succeeds Act. My access stems back to 2001, and actually there was a version of my access before it was called my access. So the state has been paying attention to students with significant cognitive disabilities for a while, and we have had to change and shift and adjust to some of the legislation that has come up over the years, and this is one of them. So some of the premises of the Every Student Succeeds Act, that it promotes access to challenging and rigorous instruction, as well as provide a gauge of student learning of that instruction. Go to the next one. It includes the use of universal design and accommodations to allow students to access the assessment. It also provides for more targeted assessments and also allows for access using alternate content expectations for students with the most significant cognitive disabilities. So if you go to the next slide. So our answer to this, Michigan's answer to this, is my access. My access is aligned, whereas MSTEP is aligned to what? What is MSTEP aligned to? It's aligned to the Michigan K-12 standards, right? Which, yes, has a connection to Common Core state standards. But my access has a set of alternate content expectations, often affectionately referred to as essential elements, that are the basis for my access. We're hoping that those alternate content expectations, which are aligned to the Michigan K-12 standards, are the basis for instruction for this population of students as well. It is designed for a relatively small portion of the population, 1%, and this is in the ESSA legislation. This is not a number that Michigan came up with. And it is designed to be used for students with the most significant cognitive disabilities. So the Michigan, Ohio, Nevada, Nebraska, all the states were tasked with were given the task to identify or to define who students with the most significant cognitive disabilities were. To which we answered, if you haven't already defined that in legislation, how could you say that it's limited to 1% of students? We've had this conversation, we've gone round and round and round. The bottom line is it's still in law, so we need to follow it. So our definition, it was based upon guidance from several different sources, and we have developed that definition. We enhanced that definition with the word "and" in all caps and all bold to cover the four areas, and which we're going to go through in a moment. And most recently, back in the fall of 2024, created a rubric to help districts, schools, identify if a student meets the definition of a student with the most significant cognitive disabilities. Anyone use that rubric? I would encourage you, if you're using that rubric, to think of that rubric as a guide to whether or not the student should be working towards the alternate content expectations. Because if you have targeted your instruction properly, then the decision on the assessment should be a no-brainer. If you're just using the rubric for the purposes of assessment, we're kind of missing a piece. Okay? Because again, that alternate assessment is aligned to alternate content expectations. So if you have a student, for example, with a specific learning disability, which you'll see later on, does not fit the definition of a student with the most significant cognitive disability, who's in the classroom, general education classroom most of the day, gets supplemental or an additional hit of instruction towards their IEP goals and objectives. Taking MyAccess doesn't make sense because they are not being tested on the standards to which they are being taught. So, I'll go on to the next one. The four categories or the four components of the definition of a student with the most significant cognitive disabilities involves an impairment of cognitive functioning, and there is, in the rubric, there are some parameters around standard scores. The point here isn't whether or not a student has a particular score on a cognitive assessment as to whether or not they meet that criteria. We will tell you to use those parameters, right? But there are some exceptions to that, and there are some things to look at relative to only able to give a nonverbal IQ score and those kind of things. Okay, but the student needs to meet all four criteria. So if a student is borderline on one, you count it yes. You move on to number two, which is an impairment of adaptive functioning, which requires multiple points of information that come in for that. So if you have a Vineland or another adaptive scale that you're using, it does need to have at least 2 points of data. So usually a parent, can be a parent, somebody from the school, but it needs to be multiple points of data. In addition to that, if the student has met the first two criteria, they must have extensive support needs to demonstrate learning and to generalize information across settings. Here, you're also looking at things like, what supports does that student need to access the general curriculum, right? Everyone, IDEA requires students be able to the maximum extent possible, participate and progress towards the general curriculum. What support needs does that mean? This is not just a list of accommodations that the student needs for an assessment. This is what are the support needs that they need for instruction, for daily living, for functioning in the classroom and at home, and for an assessment. And all of these things must be true across all settings. This is not, oh my gosh, I'm going to date myself here. Anyone here heard of the notion of the six-hour retarded child? Okay, I see a couple of people nodding their heads. This is not a student who has a significant cognitive impairment at school, but not at home. That is definitely not. I think we've gotten away from that as a field, but I think it's certainly something that sometimes inadvertently happens. So the last one is the student's level of instruction. So where are you targeting your instruction for the student? What is the highest level of instruction for the student, not the lowest level of instruction for the student? Is that primarily based on general content expectations? Is it based on alternate content expectations? If you're looking at a student who has taken MyAccess in the past, one of your litmus tests for this could be if the student has surpassed the standards, that highest level, which is not quote-unquote proficient, that would be attained, surpassed the standards, particularly if they've surpassed the standards more than once. If you look at the performance level descriptors for MyAccess functional independence, the skills and knowledge that's listed in that surpass the standards closely resembles M-STEP at the basic level. Okay, so there's your crossover. So where is instruction being targeted? If the instruction is targeted towards general content expectations, the student should be taking M-STEP. If they are working towards the high level of range of complexity for the EEs, that's functional independence, medium range, supported, low range, participation. Question?
So when we think about significant cognitive disabilities, we see that cognitive functioning is being captured for the most significant cognitive disability within 2 to 3 standard deviations.
Correct.
Right. That's the same way we identify essentially 5 standard for like a mild cognitive impairment.
Has there been any consideration that, you know, students who still fall less than the second percentile, albeit maybe 69, 68, would still meet the cognitive functioning deficit for having a significant cognitive disability?
I don't think we give a hard and fast answer on that, but the general answer is because this is intended to be for 1% of the population and the most significant cognitive disability, not any student with a cognitive disability, the answer is always defer to presuming competence and push the envelope. If you set goals for a student and they don't achieve that goal, right, we can go back and we can adjust. But if we set the bar too low for a student, they achieve that goal. And those of you who've been around for a while know what happens in reality is that, great, we've met that goal. And then the rest of the year, until those goals are adjusted, we're maintaining as opposed to pushing the student forward. So always presume competence and assume higher.
And so the same would go for adaptive, so like an Abbess or a Vineland, right? They say impaired adaptive functioning is, you know, ultimately 2 standard deviations below the mean. But we're saying the separation here is the most. So
correct.
It's more than the de minimis, more than that minimum portion, and anything beyond that is what's going to be criterion for students to take that.
Correct. I think there are some guidelines on adaptive behavior as well in the rubric, but I can't recall off the top of my head. Okay, so again, MyAccess, those only students for the most significant cognitive disabilities, ESSA caps the use at 1%, or else states must apply for a waiver and show progress at reducing rates towards compliance. And we have been in this space since we began. There is the possibility of our Title I A funds being affected by that at the state level. If we are not awarded a waiver, or if we test more than 1%, and second of all, if we do not get that waiver, so we have to show, and we have to create a plan and show progress towards reducing that number, which is a slippery slope, right? Because it's not so much about numbers as it is, we're talking about kids, right? So we want to make sure we're doing what makes sense. So the steps that we've taken in place and the fact that we've gotten more stringent on our tier designations, that's all part of that plan and what's required for us to show progress.
just want a quick question about the 1%. I know the number's the number. Has there been any consideration to the makeup of how districts within certain ISDs have operating programs where they don't educate their own kids, but yet educate kids who have significant disabilities, more severe disabilities, and that 1% impacts that number?
So the 1% cap is at the state level. Although, also in the regulations, we have to have districts provide justification if they are contributing to the state going above 1%. And our question was, how do you make that determination, particularly when you have regional programs like we have? And the answer was, any district that's above 1%. So we do that in a number of ways. Often, if an ISD program is running a program themselves that comes through by itself, obviously they're going to be higher than 1%. In some cases, they are 100% because the only programs they're running are SXI programs. In other counties, like Wayne County and Oakland County, those programs are run by a local and subsidies from the ISD. In those cases, those districts will submit in their justification form, there's a place for them to parse out students in those significant cognitive disability classrooms, in those placements, where a student was placed by an IAP team from outside the district. Now, their own kids, their own students from their own district in those programs count, but the students from outside do not. So there's an adjusted participation rate. If it's a school of choice situation, we don't parse that out, because if you open up school of choice, then you're responsible for everyone that comes. Yeah. And I know that's true not only of public school academies, but also a lot of districts as well. Yes. Yes.
Last year we hit 2%, did our justification, worked with our ISD, and I think this year we're still right around 2%, but the students keep coming, and if we go statewide, so if parents aren't happy with their local districts, they're like, oh, I'll homeschool, and we're like, no, we're not homeschooling, it's still school at home, so there's a difference, but trying to get them to understand that difference.
There's also an interesting, I could probably talk about this also. I'll just say one short thing about it. I actually worked as a superintendent for a cyber school system. And we were getting a lot of parents who did not want their kids to go back to school. COVID, they didn't want their kids to go back to school. So we were getting a lot more of students with those already identified to take my access. But when we looked at them carefully, we determined that a number of them should never have been put on my access to begin with. So it is a re-review everybody. And actually, this we'll probably touch on this later, but recent as this past fall, in our flow chart, if you're using the old blue flow chart, get rid of it, line your birdcage with it, use the green one. We have, and this actually was driven by the Office of Special Education, excluded students with specific learning disabilities, students with speech-language impairment, and students with emotional impairments. If that's their primary disability, they have been excluded from the definition of a student with the most significant disabilities. Significant cognitive disabilities, excuse me. We'll go on to the next one. So this has been kind of our history on this. We started at 2.4%, highest in the nation. We are still the highest in the nation in terms of participation in the alternate assessment, but we have come a long way. After COVID, we struggled a little bit. We continued to reduce the number of students taking the assessment, but the numbers of students overall taking the assessment varied a little bit. And so that affected our denominator. But this past year, I think with the implementation of the rubric and the flag student cases, we have been able to provide a little bit more guidance and be able to move that needle a little bit. So this year, we're at 1.6%, except for ELA, which I believe was 1.5%. We are expecting, hopefully, to receive our waiver this year. We have submitted our waiver at the beginning of January, end of December. And we're expecting to hear back from them within 3 months. We're hoping to receive that this year, although it's likely that we will not receive it in science. And the reason being is because we overall did not test 95% of students with disabilities in science this year. We tested 94.7%. The federal government does not round. So we are there. And that's been a sticking point, actually, for the past number of years for science. So where are we headed? This graphic gives you an idea of the number of students, roughly the number of students who take each level of the assessment. You can see that supported independence and participation has been fairly stable over the years. And that's really that FI number that has come down. And where we're headed in the future, overall, we're looking at trying to look at somewhere around 7,000 or so. I don't know if we'll get there or not, but we can go on to the next one. So this shows the difference between students who are on a general test track or working towards the general content expectations and those working towards the alternate and graduation outcomes. I believe this is the graduation outcomes, high school graduation, yes, based upon eighth grade curriculum exposure, test performance, and this goes back to the cohort of 2017. In a lot of cases, students who are taking the alternate assessment are in programs that are working towards the alternate content expectations and are not on a diploma track. That is based upon your district structure. That needs to be talked about when the student enters that kind of track. So if you're having these conversations with a student in third grade, this type of possible outcome needs to be discussed with parents then, not in an 11th grade, not in 10th grade. Next. We want the next one. So like we said, my access started back with supported independence and participation back in 2001. Functional independence was added in 2005. And for a very short period of time, we had MEEP access, which was not aligned to alternate content expectations. Those were aligned to the K-12 standards. So students who took MEEP access for those few years should have been moved back to what? Should have been moved back to MSTEP, or it was MEEP at the time, but yes. But when ESSA came out, it prohibited the use of that 2% assessment, which they just told us a few years prior we could do. So we had to backpedal on that and get rid of MEEP access in order to have an alternate assessment at all. Yes. 2014, we added social studies at the FI level. We had a pilot in 2014. 2015, we went operational for the first time. That is an area that is evolving as well. Does anyone know what happened to the K-12 social studies standards in 2019? Very end of 2019. Yes, there's not a lot of agreement in terms of those standards, but they did come to a consensus, and state board adopted new K-12 social studies standards at the very end of 2019. Then what happened in 2020?
COVID.
So how many districts were raring to go and implementing something new? Well, cyber is a little different, right? You guys were in survival mode, right? So we did give extra time. We usually do give time from the time standards are revised to the time we test them, right? Because we don't want to change standards in January and test on them in April. That's not fair, right? So we want to give districts a chance to adjust. We also needed time to write new items. So in 2024, We were, the MSTEP was fully aligned, social studies was fully aligned to the new standards. And in 2025, we had new standard setting. And now we're turning our attention to the alternate content expectations for social studies. We do that not because the alternate content expectations are not as important, but we want to make sure that nothing else is going to change, and we don't want to introduce multiple levels of change to our most vulnerable population. So we received input from our advisory group. We received input from anyone from here from Wayne County? We received some feedback from folks in Wayne County who worked on the Wayne County Alternate Assessment for Social Studies, or PNSI. Got some good feedback from them. And we got public comment. And we are currently in the process of taking all that information and cleaning up our drafts. Currently, there are new revised FI Social Studies drafts on the MyAccess website for social studies standards. Those will be changing, so please watch. We just need to finish getting them cleaned up, run them through editorial, and then get MDE leadership to weigh in and to approve them. So, no, because we do not have state level alternate content expectations for participation, supported independence level. So for you guys, you do, because Wayne County created them for Wayne County. But what that looks like, what social studies looks like for a student in Wayne County, looks very different than a student who might be in Calumet. So that was part of the original design of MyAccess Social Studies, was it was only at the FI level, linked to history, social studies, because for the population of students in the PNSI level, social studies often meant me and my community. Okay, so. On to administration pieces.
Okay. Also, as we're going through this, if you do have a question, I'll try to get to the mic to you as quick as I can. Part of it is for recording, not so much for hearing, but to get the recording. So thank you, John, for all of that good information. And hopefully there'll be some things here that will make sense. Number one, and probably the biggest change to all of MyAccess this year is in FI. We have gone away from a paper answer document, and it is online. So the student experience is still going to be the same. They're still going to mark their answers in the booklet, and this applies to the accessing print, mathematics, science, social studies. They will mark their answers, responses in the booklet like they normally have, but instead of administrators transferring or transcribing over to a paper answer document, it will be online, and so that is done through the DRC Insight portal. There are some setup instructions that need to go along with that because it requires a login credential, much like an online test, but it's for the FI answer document. So that is one of the biggest changes. I'm going to refer to this a little bit more. Now, excluding from that is the expressing ideas, which is writing and drawing portion of the ELA test. We don't have a mechanism just quite yet to go online with that, and we don't have anything in the near future, but who knows, maybe AI will help us get there quicker. We'll see. But that is primarily something that maybe John would be involved with in the future. If we ever go to a online platform for expressing ideas, it would be a ways to go.
Part of the challenge with that is that students have the ability to write and to draw. And so our rubric allows students to express their ideas either way. Also, there's a lot of inventive spelling that takes place with MyAccess expressing ideas. And we want to make sure that all of those are human scored. And we also don't want to measure a student's disability or to type as opposed to express their ideas in some way.
And we also have to work with our vendor, of course, to make sure that the technology will work in conjunction with their machinery and their system of scoring as well. The answer documents are grade specific this year. They used to be a grade span. You would have a 3 through 8 or 11, but those are now specific to the grades. So those are a little bit, we did have some confusion with processing, and we had to make a lot of corrections. This is to help alleviate that. And the last thing is word processing. Last year, we did not have that capability, but DRC has a new system whereby they can work with word process. It seems kind of antiquated. I almost thinking, when I hear of word processor, I think of typewriters. I'm not sure if we use them much anymore. We don't get too many, but it is available. There are instructions on how to put that together. Touch on that here real quickly. Yes.
So after we pre-identify and everything like that, normally we would receive, in the mail, all of the ELA stuff. Are we not receiving any of that stuff anymore?
The only thing that you would get is you would get your order like you normally would, but we don't go rummaging around for paper answer documents. That will be the key right there, because it will look a little bit different because you've always expected it. So yes, that will be a change. Like I said, the students will provide their answers or responses directly in the test booklet. The test administrator would then, of course, log in and put it into an online transcription form. Now, keep in mind, when they do that, it doesn't necessarily look like a true bubble document. You'll actually go through the form and just enter those scores just like they are in the booklet from the student. And we do have some resources. The OLAD, that's the online, we love acronyms. That's the online answer document. There is a mini module that is in the DRC website, along with a bunch of other things in their library for training and so forth. I don't think I can play that here, but I think, yeah, it's available on their webpage in the mini modules section. Yes.
I just wanted to clarify too, please resist the urge to take a student's paper booklet and assign them a test ticket for the online assessment. The online form and the paper form are not exactly the same. So it's important that you are putting your answers into that online answer document for the paper assessment.
And this is a little bit more detail about the word process. The instructions are in the manual. If you go to the word process section, it will actually have a diagram showing how that is set up. There's you have to print it, label it with the litho code that comes with it. So there's some specific guidelines to go to make sure it's within the scoring range of the answer document, and then taping it to the document. I see some folks are taking pictures, so I'll let you go ahead and take those. I'm sorry. Did you want to take a picture there? There you go. Okay. Do not score labels. We used to send those with our inventory. Those are not used anymore. Obviously, we don't have near the number of answer documents that need this particular label. So those are not included. If you do have a do not score situation, we do recommend you file an incident report. That will at least get us to the point where we can make a decision, we can document it, and there's really no questions going forward. New to Michigan this year is a code for most significant cognitive disabilities. This is a warning that shows up in our pre-ID, and it is another one of our warnings, and I'll get to some others in just a few minutes. It is a warning that can be overridden. It's to alert you to the fact that there may be, based on the code, that this student is not appropriate for MyAccess. So, John, go ahead.
So that code was added to have districts be able to help keep track of students that have gone through and used the rubric. So if you've got a student who you've used the rubric on, you've come to that conclusion, you can use that code in MSDS to alert yourself to who it is. So it's not that code. It will throw a message. Like Dan said, it's a warning if it's not used, but it is also if there's nobody in your district that's listed on, you have students taking MyAccess, but it can be very, very helpful for you in terms of keeping track, and so that's why that was added.
Okay. Hi. Well, I was just showing Dan that I was actually doing that yesterday with one of my with other testing coordinators. It popped up, and I was like, okay, well, I'm going to this conference tomorrow. I make sure I ask them. So how do we get past that? Because the big yellow thing popped up saying that the student, I guess, you know, doesn't qualify for my access, but they do.
Well, there's this particular warning. There's a couple of different warnings. So this particular warning is about the use, of that new box. It's a checkbox, essentially. But okay. There are other warnings about if a student, if their FTE is high, it would indicate the student's receiving most of their instruction in the general education mm-hmm. setting. Okay. If they've got a disability that is primary disability that is not consistent with the definition of the most significant cognitive
disability. And I think that's what it is.
It will give you that warning. And my understanding is you can continue to order as normal. There's nothing that will prevent you from ordering the material. But it's a flag for you to go back and look at that student case.
Okay, I have to go back and look because when it popped up, I was like, well, let me, you know, when I come to...
It's a flag, and it's really meant to do is to help the special ed folks talk with the folks that are ordering the materials, which are not always the same people.
Right. Okay.
I was only going to add that I think the information comes from CEPI, right? So, like, sometimes within the count period, like, if you have a student that you've evaluated that's different from the first count period to the second count period, it should update with that information after so many days. I've seen it's updated right after the recertification cycle. So like if your student didn't meet criteria and then all of a sudden something happened and reevaluated and gone through all those things and they meet the criteria, once this certification period ends and by March it should pop up.
Right. I'm the resource.
They came from my school. They came from my school. The student was in the ASD self-contained, but that was still too much for them, so they were transferred now to our school, which is KLC, which, you know, every classroom is self-contained, but most of the students in there, they all take my access. So I was just over there because she's a new testing coordinator trying to help her input, you know, to pre-identify, and I was like, I've never seen this before because most of my students in my school, they usually do take the M-STEP, you know, or I have my access to our self-contained. So that was my first time ever seeing that, so I was like, I'm not sure if maybe – like you said about the IEP, because they did transfer over from that this program to another program.
One of two things. There's something that flags. It could be, you know, if it's a student that's recently identified, maybe the last count period they were not identified. So that's it's not going to prevent them from being able to register for my access. But it is a flag. So we want to get people talking to say, is this right for this student?
Yeah, and that's a good point, John. These are designed for conversation. Did we miss something? And in some cases, it may be an error. There may be, like you said, there may be a situation that once you review it, you say, okay, we can move forward. Tina is actually looking at a possibility of having a sign-off by the district, but we'll see how the discussions go. So maybe some of these warnings can go away that you acknowledge. We currently have acknowledged when you log into the secure site that you've read all of the FERPA stuff and so forth. But moving forward, those are overridable, but I'm going to talk about warnings here in just a few seconds, so we'll get to that. The rubric, there is a slight change. You will see we've processed away from hand over hand, primarily for SIMP, where we are now using the phrase step-by-step instruction. This was, I believe, a field request, and it was brought to our attention with regards to technical language used and best practices for observational assessment. And you have something on that, John?
Yeah, it doesn't change at all how the assessment is given. The rubric did give an example of hand-over-hand assistance, and that was written back in the early 2000s. Which basically illustrates how instruction can and should continue after you've scored the item. Now we are trying to be less prescriptive about how you provide that instruction or correction after the assessment item has been scored. It's whatever is appropriate for that student.
Some other things that are new, the DRC OTTs, which is the online tools training, the practice test, if you will. The design has changed a little bit. You'll probably see that right away. But functionality is pretty much the same as what you have had in the past. There is a change to the link. So just take note of that. And also, if you have, we always remind folks, if they can, if they use it frequently and enough, make sure the bookmark that you currently have has been replaced with the updated one. One other thing we're looking at in the OTTs. I know there's a discussion. Some have asked for, well, is there an answer key? Can we score these things? So that's in the works, but stay tuned. I don't know if there's a timeline. We're trying to get all of the discussions in to make sure we can set those up for you and they're appropriate. The last one there is a known issue. It may be resolved by the time we start testing, but no, not quite. Okay, thanks, John. It's where the highlighter on the online test doesn't stick with the text. It sticks to the background. So if you have some change in the screen dynamic, moving, it may look kind of squirrely, or the highlight will move to some other part of that line above or below, depending on which directions you go. So just be aware of that. It's a known issue, and they're still working hard to get that done.
If you're an MSDEP coordinator, that's the reason why we don't use the passage slider for the ELI items, because we know the highlighter is used heavily for MSDEP writing.
Yeah. Okay, here are the warnings. Now, these warnings were, of course, to start the conversation and alert you to what we're seeing, and we're hoping that you see it as well through some of these. They can be overridden. In these first few groups here, we have the disability type. It doesn't match with their primary disability, so you may get a warning on that. The primary instruction as well, John had mentioned about the FTE, where it doesn't quite line up with their primary instruction. And so that it will trigger that. Past performance, if we have a student who is acing everything every year and it's just maybe there's something we should take a look at. And here, once again, starting the conversation about where is the student at in terms of testing. Go ahead.
One thing on that I will mention. Please do what makes sense. So if you come to this conclusion in March that, oh, we really need to raise the bar on instruction for a student and testing starts in April, don't change their test yet, because they haven't been taught to those content expectations yet, right? So you'd be thinking about the next year out. So still be fair to the students. Don't pull the rug out and test them on my MSDEP 2 weeks after you've started teaching those expectations.
And also this last one here, SINP, we do not have social studies as far as the state assessment, so there would probably be a reminder of that. It is, just as a reminder, I think I'll touch on it a little bit later, that it's actually notified during the not tested window in early June where you enter those. So nothing has changed there. Yes?
Another question. Back to the pre-identifying, say a student has surpassed, I'm going to give an example, say they're in fourth grade this year, but third grade, they were participation, and they surpassed ELA or attained, but they didn't pass math. So for this upcoming school year for fourth grade, would they still take the same test, even though they pay, like pass one portion and not the other, or do they take the same participation?
You do have the ability to do different levels as long as they're adjacent to one another, but okay. That would be a flag for the IEP team to make some conversations, have some conversations about where you're targeting instruction, and then that decision should drive where the assessment goes.
Okay, so
you won't get the warning for participation supported independence for this surpassed. You'll only get it if that's true for functional independence.
Got it. Okay, so they can choose one for, let's say, ELA for supportive, and then they need to do participation for math. Just right. Example, they yeah. can. Okay.
Within one step, yes. And part of the reason why we went to that was because we were hearing that Students who were ready to move in one content area and not another were still being instructed towards the lower standards on the area that they could have been moved ahead on. And we don't want to inadvertently prevent people from moving a student forward.
So this page looks very much like the one before, but I would tell you this. These are warnings that come with consequences, okay? So as we were mentioning, the non-adjacent, if you're doing an SI and a P, you can alternate if the IEP team puts them in one and the other. That's okay. Those are adjacent. Where we get into trouble is if we step over a complete level and test in those like functional independence and participation. At that point, then, we have to make a decision, which one do we take? And so that invalidates the test right there. These will invalidate the test.
I've seen SI and SIT before. That's invalid as well.
We surprisingly, yes, we have seen a number of them. And we get into SAT. We also talk in math and ELA as a unit. And sometimes they split that up, and that also will invalidate it. But moving on to the next one, the SE or the special ed flag, we have done fairly well over the years. If the student is not flagged as special ed, the scores will be invalidated.
Real quick, special ed folks, special ed directors, if you get a call or an email from Tori Steinberger from Office of Special Ed, she might be calling about this because we're trying to catch a lot of these proactively. So please pay attention to that name if you get a call or an email.
And we do also have in the secure site the ability to sort by special ed, so by that flag. So it provides you with a little opportunity to just run through a checklist of things that you know that you need to get fixed or things that you need to look up. That's one of them right there. Multiple assessments, we will, if you pre-ID'd for MSTEP math and FI math, you're going to get a warning. Because if you move ahead with both of them, one of them is going to be invalidated. We have to make a decision. Generally, we will opt for the. I think we look at the most complete test, the one that is the highest level. It seems a bit unfair that we have to try to make that decision. But you're going to get a warning that one of them is going to be invalidated. So all of these can create an invalidation.
We don't ask our students without disabilities to take more than one assessment, so we should not be asking our students with the most significant cognitive disabilities to take two assessments.
Yes, they are. But bear in mind that if SI or FI and SAT, which would be kind of rare, just remember that the math and the ELA for SAT is a unit.
Right.
They have to be together. Yeah. Correct. Now, they could take
science.
You know.
Well, now it's the WIN assessment, WIN, the work skills readiness. That, I believe, is allowable.
Any other questions on these? I highly recommend getting a hold of our OEAA email address. I think most of you have that. Tina would be glad to walk you through some of these if you do have a question about how to override them. Overriding basically doesn't stop you from continuing with your orders or whatever you're doing in the secure site. They are there to help with the conversation, but these right here are worth noting.
And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, there's not an override button. You just continue with your order.
That's correct. Yeah. So, John, just confirming, this is your new, the new and improved?
Yes. When I say green, this is the one because the other one didn't have green in it. yes, the decisions are all in green here. Here we excluded students with specific learning disabilities, emotional disabilities, and students with speech and language impairments from the definition. And so that's up there and also reflected a bit on the back as well. So if you have the old one, please get rid of it. But this is located in two different places on the MyAccess website, and you certainly use these.
And the reverse side of that is particularly helpful because it does lay out some things to do and things not to do, because there are some assumptions often that are made when these types of decisions are going forward that you fail to recognize one or two things. So the reverse side is very helpful. And this all kind of started way back when, who remembers No Child Left Behind, the 3 through 8 and 11. Science and social studies have changed grades somewhat over the years, but these are the content areas that are being assessed. And for the social studies, that is for functional independence only. And the social studies for them are actually at the local level. And I think I get into that in just a second, but that's reported during the not tested window. We do have some districts that actually create their own SINP social studies assessment.
Big plug for Wayne County. If you live in Wayne County, check with the ISD. They've got one.
Yeah, Wayne County. And Genesee has also got some up at Marion Krause. I remember we looked at how thoughtful they went through the process. They've served on a lot of our committees, and they said, we think we can do this right here in-house, and they did. So there's a number of resources out there if you need to get a hold of them.
Ottawa used to have one as well. I don't know if they still do. But
I would imagine they would, yeah. Yeah. So contact us, or we'll give you our card here if we need to put you in touch with some of those. So that is reported for SINP during the not tested window. Spotlight, we'll let everyone know. Everyone signed up for Spotlight. What we try to do is only give you what is kind of coming up. Just as reminders, we try to stale information, we quickly delete from it and just let you know what is coming up this week, next week, or a short period ahead. The MyAccess webpage, just to plug that for you, at the top you will see some critical icons. They are the content standards, the guidelines, the OEA secure site, coordinator training. It is built into small, digestible chapters that will walk you through any kind of training that you need. The Spotlight, of course, is also listed at the top, My School Data, and the contact information where you can get a hold of Tina. This appears pretty much on all of our program web pages. One feature, too, is we have an assessment calendar webpage. As you'll see there, the bigger document, it has the list of important dates. Those are the kind that just a single page, if you need it for reference sake. It's a PDF. We also have an Excel spreadsheet, which allows you, if you're handling multiple assessments, an Excel spreadsheet will allow you to filter by exactly what you have. And then you can take the start dates and just, I mean, you can filter to try and figure out what do I have to do this next month or by the 1st of March. You can sort by that. The calendar there is listed in most of our publication. It shows all of the spring assessments and where MyAccess kind of fits into the overall battery of tests that are coming up. And, of course, that icon at the top of the page is this thing right over here. That's on the web page. It will take you directly to the website where you can do the Google Calendar as well. For those that really like the ability to have Google set alerts and notifications for you, that is also available on the assessment calendar web page. This right here is a training piece. It's a single page. It's listed on our web page. And it's divided on the left side by this is for functional independence. Provides a side-by-side visual of the online and the paper. So on the green here, those are your paper assessments. The light orange over here, those are the online activities. Now, you'll notice down at the bottom there, we have one. Sorry, I have somebody. Keep going. You're okay. So we have arrows here. This is for the online answer document. It reminds you to go online. So we have to move over to that lane and do the entries for the transcription for because of the no paper answer document. It goes online. The one good thing about that is it does get captured along with online submissions, online testing submissions. And so your paper will begin to show up in our preliminary reports 48 hours. So that's a big change. Up till now, we've had to say wait until late summer, which I know you guys are thinking way beyond that. So, yeah, that does give us some option there. I will point out one thing. Wherever there's red, there's usually a reason for it. This particular one right here is the expressing ideas. That's the writing test. It's the only one that's paper. But it has to come back for scoring. And the critical part of that makes this a red arrow is because we need that for a combined ELA score. Whether they're testing paper on paper or online, we need that back to score to marry it up with the scoring in order to get a valid ELA score. So that's why it's red. Really important that that comes back. And the pre-ID orders, if you have students pre-ID for ELA FI, you will get these tests. You will get the test, and just confirm that with the orders. We've made sure that we have some backup logic that allows us to say, did you really actually have more students, and you need exactly 5 instead of 15, or 15 instead of 5. This is also in the test administration manual and posted on the web page. Just as reminders, the FI is for one administrator. It's one-on-one. The students mark the test booklet, and then it is entered into the new online answer document online. And the online testing is student-facing. While the administrator can provide some navigational help, this really is a situation where you know your student well enough to know when things are not going the direction they should be in terms of engagement. So, it is student-facing. All secure material should be stored in between assessment. The rule is don't leave it out, kind of like money. Don't leave it. Don't just leave it on the table. Put it away. Store it, lock it, and there are specific instructions on how to handle the secure materials. So double check on your security training. That is also part of the requirement for training. Yes.
I just want to make sure, because I did call yesterday and spoke to a rep for OEAA, and I asked about the functional, because I was reading online, so it's not a primary and a shadow for functional anymore, just the primary?
That's for SIP.
Okay. Because when I asked, they said you still need it both for functional. And I was like, okay, well, I just read that. That's what they told me. So
Do you know who you talked to?
I write everything down. So it's hideous. I have it written on my desk.
You're going to let me know. Because
when I read it, I said, I think it's supposed to be one. But if you say so, I'm not, going to go against what you said.
Student-facing. Okay.
So right. it's just for functional, just the primary one.
Probably call center.
You're correct. Okay. That is correct, yes. Yes, and please let us know, because some of that has to go with the training. Probably somebody just flipped the wrong page or whatever, because it could have been on the next page, for all we know. This is the same thing for SIMP. This gives you a side-by-side. People have asked, is it online or paper pencil? Because the secure site, it's kind of confusing at times when you're ordering. The answer is yes, it's both. So you have the assessment in green is pretty much handled by paper, and it is with two administrators, the primary administrator, which we call the PAA, and the shadow. The primary just basically runs the assessment. The shadow is a secondary, and I'll get into some of that here in just a second. This is also on the web page. It also shows where you have to go online and begin to set up the session so that when you get done with the paper pencil, you can go over here and begin to enter them into the online answer document. I'll show you an image of that real soon. all the paperwork and everything comes back. We've got the deadlines down at the bottom there to get that information back to. It's also listed in the important list of important dates. Like I mentioned, the two administrators, the primary and the shadow, and they use the paper booklets. The booklets are not designed. In fact, they're titled Assessment Administrator Booklet. So they're specifically designed for the administrator. The picture cards are listed as student picture cards. So the designation is that they be separated. The student really does not look at the booklet, and they use picture cards. They do that independently and simultaneously. Sometimes their scores are identical. That's okay. Sometimes they're adjacent. We understand sometimes a student may start to react and one administrator sees it different than the other. So not to worry too much. The scores are combined, and they get an overall score from that.
Yeah, there was a rumor going around a few years ago that said, if your scores don't match, your test's going to be invalidated, and that's absolutely false. They just get added together.
Yeah, those are the raters. Our scores are combined together for an overall. There are two different types of items on the test: activity-based observations. These are types of things that are observed on their way to the lunchroom, or on the playground, or in classroom, as well as selected response, which is the picture cards, or any adaptations, which I mentioned in the second one, or just below that. We have seen a variety of different objects being used for assessment, just to engage the student, everywhere from leaves from a tree to an ironing board. So we've seen just about everything. And after the testing, the primary will test the test tickets, or be in contact with the coordinator to get the test tickets and enter those scores into the online answer document. Yes?
The test coordinator to be the one to enter them in the computer from the paper that they got from the primary and the shadow. And they hand them over and the coordinator put them in.
Put it this way, there is a, we do request that they sign that these are theirs and they're entering them, if at all possible. We do have some situations, I do believe, where the centers have had somebody, a coordinator, actually is either a part of the assessment, have entered them as well.
What we want to avoid is having the primary enter it and then the shadow enter it separately. They go together. And whether it's a coordinator entering it for everybody, or whether it's the primary, I think that's a bit of a judgment call, but just keep in mind that whatever the coordinator, if you're the coordinator putting that in, that you're putting that on behalf of the teacher who's ultimately responsible for that information. So,
well, I will say the test administration may probably the
primary.
Yes.
I think there are situations in which that might make sense, depending upon how your program is set up and how your school is structured.
Is it the person who's primary and the shadow, they don't have access.
Access.
They have to come to a different building.
I see.
To do it, so they usually just have.
Okay.
And we confess that we haven't heard directly that this has probably happened multiple times, but I, like John said, very close discretion on what you do with that. That's what the scoring documents look like when you're testing the student. It has the rubric along the top there, so it kind of keeps you on track, and then the primary and the shadow. This particular one happens to be science. You'll notice there's a big, ugly black line right across the bottom of it. And that's designed for some of the higher grades. 8 and 11 are those four at the bottom. Fifth grade is just at the top. So instead of, you know, having two different documents, we just have one This just happened to be science. So ELA and math are and social studies and science are very similar, and you would mark it. You have the designation at the top for your role and the signature down at the bottom. Those are to be kept on at the district for at least 3 years. That's a retention period.
And they won't have this for social studies because this is just participation-supported independence.
Correct. it also has, at the top there, we have the form number. What will happen is if you do not select the form number when you're entering these scores, it won't take the entries. It keeps, you can't override this one. We do need the form, and it's a very easy fix. Put that in, and it'll allow you to go ahead, but it will give you a notification of that.
Right in the front of the assessment administrator booklet. Yeah.
The supported independence answer document is a green grid, so that's what it looks like when you go in and log in. There's the form number up at the top there, way up there. That's where you select the form from the booklet, so we need to know what form booklet they were in. The next one down is the participation. That was in blue, so that's what the participation answer document looks like. We purposely did that. DRC did this because it just helps to identify that you're entering two different things.
And we do colors, have those colors match the colors of the booklets too. So
yes, we do have some where they get it mixed up. Unfortunately, yes, mistakes do happen. File an incident report. I will probably be the one regenerating it. You just go back in, print a new ticket, to start all over again. So it's pretty quick and easy. We can fix it for you. Now, these are scrollable, too. So you can see over on the sides here, they're very small. But you can see, it only looks like it displays five or six there. Those are scrollable. And the gray part, which is in the second part of the answer document, is where the shadow would enter, or the scores from the shadow would be entered. One hint that really works well, if you have a touchscreen device, that is really quick and easy. Oftentimes, navigating a mouse right over a bubble can be tedious. This seems to work incredibly well. We've tried a few of those. Just as an idea, I'd also mention the scrolling part of it. Don't forget, you can actually just grab the sheet and just pull it up. Just swipe up, and it will scroll down for you. So things to help you navigate. When you do have a pile of those, you have to enter. Could I encourage you, though, that if you do have testing at the end of the day, just go ahead and start entering the information. Don't wait till the end. Oftentimes, we get most of our incident reports in the last week, unfortunately. But if you could enter them earlier, we can get those handled for you real quickly. Last reminders, the special ed flag has to be set. Expressing ideas is the only paper answer document, and that has to be sent back whether they're doing online or paper. The online answer document is completed by the test administrators. And accommodated versions must be documented in the IEP. That is a given. We do have some situations where they discover mid-test that they neglected to handle the accommodation properly. Go ahead and fill out an incident report. We deal with a lot of these. You may have to get parent permission to test again and so forth, but we get a resolution for you. So any questions on testing at all? It doesn't hurt to file an incident report. Some people have just filed just FYI. They just wanted to let you know, hey, we found a whole bunch of our booklets. They're going to be running a little late, but we're shipping them in. We've had them do that. Some of the explanations are pretty benign, but they are questions that we could answer for them, and it never hurts to communicate.
I have a quick something to add to what you're saying in terms of important reminders. My Access Functional Independence Online, the students taking it online, there are a lot of those tools and supports that are actually considered universal for the My Access Functional Independence assessment. So you may have a student whose IEP says that they need text-to-speech to access print online. which is fine. There's no reason for it not to be in their IEP if that's what they do. But you don't have to turn it on like you do for MSTEP. Text-to-speech is automatically turned on for as a universal tool for FI online. If you have a student for whom the text-to-speech is not appropriate for some reason, it's better for them to read it, which gets into the question about cognition again, right? You can turn the volume down, but keep in mind there is a listening section in accessing print and using language that they do need to listen to.
True. Paper pencil would have the listening scripts included with the order, but the online, you're right, it there are a couple of items that require that they hear it. We started a little early, but we have about nine more minutes left. If there's any questions, if not, we will hang around for at least nine more minutes. And anything that you can that we can do for you. Thanks for being here. You could have been somewhere else, but you chose us. So thank you.